Hello and welcome to the Massachusetts Farm to Table podcast, where we explore the fields, kitchens, and stories that make the Massachusetts food scene so special. I'm your host, Nissa Gadbois. Each week, we'll connect with farmers, food producers, and the community that makes the Commonwealth's food scene so vibrant. Join me as we meet the passionate farmers, food producers, and chefs who are shaping the farm-to-table movement right here in Massachusetts. Hello and welcome back to the Massachusetts Farm-to-Table podcast. This is part two of my interview with Lindsay Baird from Oak and Ash Farm in Belchertown. If you missed part one, go back and listen to that and then join me back here for part two. Thanks for tuning in. So you mentioned permaculture and regenerative ag. So how did you all come to that path?
Slowly. There are a lot of things we're sort of looking at again now, because we didn't know we were going to be on the regenerative ag path when we started. And if we did, we would have done things very differently. So we're doing a lot of, well, we wouldn't have done that if we had known we were going to do this later, like undoing a lot of hard work we've already done. But it started with, again, like my husband has a full-time job, which is frustrating, but also important. It allows us to really, allows us the freedom to take big leaps and say, okay, we're going to spend the money to put this thing in, because we're not completely dependent on, you know, the income of that I'm making off of the farm. But he started with reading The Holistic Orchard and was just very interested in that. He's a hunter. He's, again, spent so much time in nature, and he really helped me sort of understand hunters in a different way. But he's seen nature in a way that I've never seen it and experienced it, because, you know, sitting in a tree stand for hours and hours and hours, he observes, he takes it all in. And so he also, again, is very interested in educating himself. We call ourselves, like, we're great collectors of knowledge and skills. Like, we're always trying to add on another thing. So it started with the orchard, and then he found Charles Dowding, which is probably familiar to a lot of people on YouTube, No Dig Gardening. And then he wanted to learn more about regenerative farming. And so it kind of just was like a trickle effect. And then once he pulled me in, I was like, absolutely. So now it's gotten to the point where he does, like, he has a bigger general view of, like, what we're doing on the farm. Mm-hmm. From he's doing, practicing interesting things with pollarding and coppicing trees as a form of orchard management. He wants to see if you pollard a maple tree, can you get it to grow bigger, quicker, so that you can produce maple syrup? You know, can you, we do lots of wattle fences around here. So we're like, we're combining all these different, like, methods and testing them out, but it now has taken it where I can look at an area and say, okay, let's look at what's going on in nature around it. Take our cues from that. What's growing already? What does this want to be? Mm-hmm. And how do we make that, how do we work with that concept and make it better where we can produce more food, again, either for ourselves or for wildlife? And how can we improve upon it? So we just kind of take that. And once you get the basics of, like, the regenerative principles down, it's so easy to just immediately apply it to an area. You know, you're observing, you're taking it in, and then you're saying, okay, how can I make this that much better, but still, you know, still keeping nature in mind and improving the soil in the process. So we've put in a lot of our tree rows, our polyculture tree rows. They're mixes of, like, wild plums and we've got our nitrogen fixers and berries. We had a lot of berries growing on the property when we came here. So we just said, okay, well, we're really good at growing berries already. Part of why we bought this property was there were wild blueberries growing on the property already. So since we have moved here and cleared land and given it a little more light and also brought in things like aronia berries, our native pollinator population has exploded. And because of that, our berry production has exploded because there's so many more native bees. We have tons and tons and tons of mason bees and big giant fat bumblebees. And they are working their little tushies off during orchard season. They're just everywhere. My blue orchard mason bees have become my favorite thing in the world. They are so cute and they're very docile and they're very shy. If you go too close, they'll like hide. Aww. But they're amazing little workers. And it is amazing because we have thousands of them and there are bees. They don't have the range of a honeybee. They can only go so far. So those are our bees. And we have allowed that population to just explode because there's just so much here for them to eat. So it's been really amazing to watch that happen. Yeah. That's been like my favorite side effect, so to speak, of doing farming the way we're doing it is seeing how it's benefited the native population.
It's so exciting when you see that something you've done has such a dramatic positive impact. Yes. Feel really good about yourself. What you do, and you're like, oh, feeling at one with nature here, everybody. It's so good, though.
And that's why, like, I taught this past year. I taught at the NOFA Summer Conference. I did a small scale regenerative food systems course, and which I'd love to do more of that. So, if you know of anyone else, I love to talk about this. I'm not an expert, but I love to share what I've learned because it is so exciting. It's so amazing to actually see what happens. And the very first thing I tell people, whether you have a tiny little postage stamp of a yard that you want to turn into, you know, a regenerative little food system, or you have a huge piece of land, is like, look around you first, make the observation, look what's already growing there. But then that also opens you up to see that when you do start making changes, that all of the benefits that come with it. So my favorite thing to do is sit on my front steps early in the morning, just when the sun is kind of coming out and the bees are getting to work. And I have been bonked in the side of the head by a bumblebee because I was sitting in its path between, you know, one plant and another that I wanted to get to. And it didn't sting me. It just went like, oh, you're in my way. But watching all of the life around me, like goldfinches just like absolutely explode, and bluebirds and robins, and just thousands and thousands of insects that are just so happy and just have so much food, and watching them pollinate is so wonderful. And then it ends up with things like last year, me pulling like 50 pounds of pole beans out of my three sisters planting up front because they just, wow. I was picking them and they just kept pollinating them in this tiny little area. You know, I give them food and so they reward me with food. And it's a really amazing thing to see.
A nice relationship, right? To have with the animals in your system. And you don't really have to do much of anything. So much easier than taking care of goats.
I always say goats are the one that, I know, never say never, but goats are like the bottom of my list. I just can't do goats. That is one that I just can't do. Anything.
So you said you're always learning new skills and doing new things. And you mentioned a cookbook that you're writing. What other new things are coming up for you on your farm?
Well, the cookbook is actually written. It just needs to be published, which is very, I'm actually going to be working on crowdfunding that, because my cookbook is I'm very proud of it. I worked with a local photographer who did amazing work on it. And it's called the New England Table, and it's about eating beautifully all season long. And I really did want to show people that, you know, New England has such a rich history of food. A lot of that is, I'd love to learn so much more about indigenous tribes and their farming methods and their cooking methods, because so much of what we have is, you know, our food comes from them. And, you know, a lot of that knowledge comes from them. But we have, you can really eat really beautiful food even through the winter. And, you know, I have like a whole ode to ugly vegetables in there. Things like celeriac and, you know, things that go in, you know, people don't really think about, but they're really great things. So I will be doing some crowdfunding for that, because I would really love to get it out there. I'm very passionate about it. It has a lot of stories about the food and the recipes, where they came from. There's a recipe for Down East baked beans, because my husband, again, grew up basically, you know, spending his whole summer in Down East Maine. And it uses a indigenous bean called Jacob's cattle beans in them instead of like a navy bean. I have been, over the last year, so we've done, the last 2 years, we've done a small CSA. Mm-hmm. And with that CSA, I was producing sourdough bread. And I had so many people sort of beg me to make it available outside of the CSA. So I have my kitchen certified, and I do pop-ups and porch pickups for sourdough bread and products. And what's really great about that is I'm using local grains from Ground Up Grain. And they used to be in Hadley, but now they're in, I think, Chicopee or Holyoke. And I love, it's so in sync with our model, because they are using, a lot of times they're working with farmers who are using grains that are, they're using them as a cover crop. And so they're then taking that and turning it into, you know, delicious local grain products. So I use their flour almost exclusively. Some things I need to go outside. So I have that, and I'm working on getting my state license for production for some of my sourdough products, so that I can expand where I sell them. And I will be, excuse me, I will be at the Belchertown Farmers Market this year for the first time. This is the first time I've ever done a market. I really liked the CSA model, because it's, you know, I know when I pick something, it's going right in a box and it's going right into, you know, on someone's table. But I will be doing markets this year. And teaching a lot of classes. Again, that's kind of my passion. And I love combining that, the food knowledge, you know, culinary is my background, and the farming, and showing people really new and inventive ways to eat what I'm producing, and to also help them produce them too. Like, I'm teaching a whole class on edible flowers. A lot of people don't know that you can eat a lot of flowers.
Yeah. So,
they're beautiful, and then you can eat them. So I love to teach people how to use the things that I grow, but also how they can also use things that they grow that they may not know how to use. Because I do find that that happens a lot. You know, somebody goes to start a farm or a garden, and they, you know, plant 1,000 zucchini products, and they're like, well, I don't plants. And they're like, well, I don't like zucchini. It's like, you don't have to grow the traditional things. You can do something a little bit differently. You know, and teaching people, you know, we grow these aronia berries, and a lot of people don't even know what they are. So trying to help people think outside the box a little bit, with what they're eating. So I'm hoping to do a few more of those classes. And we'll be doing our third round of meat birds this year. So,
how many meat birds do you have right now?
Well, they're coming this week. So we usually do 65 at a time. Mm-hmm. Originally, it started where we thought 50, and we'll give ourselves, you know, we'll give ourselves a little wiggle room for, you know, any that don't make it. But we've landed pretty close to 65 every time. We don't lose very many now that we figured it out. So usually we do three rounds of meat birds. This year, I was only able to get two processing dates, though. Getting them certified at a USDA facility is a It's a big hurdle for a lot of us farmers.
Yes.
It's not very cost effective. So I will be doing two, and then our third round will be just for us, and those will self-process. But everything that we sell, you know, has to come through the USDA facility. So that gets tricky.
That does. I think a lot of customers don't really realize how much of our pricing is based on somebody else's service that we need, or some input that we might need that we can't produce ourselves. Yeah, it's such a shame, because I bet you're like we are when we see what the fees are going to be. My first thought is always, oh my gosh, that's going to make it so expensive for folks to buy it. Is it going to put them off? And everybody's so tight as it is. I mean, I think especially since the pandemic, everybody's been just super, super tight. And you want to make sure you can make it affordable and available to folks too. Yeah, it's really been tough. I mean, we were talking about the rain last year impacting hay. And it's just the price of hay has exploded. If you need to buy it in, it's incredible. And last year there were issues with grain. So anybody who needed to bring in grain, there were things going wrong with the grain, and the grain was going way higher. And oh gosh, it's just.
Well, there were, even just with ground up grain, I was getting my organic bread flour from them. And then I got an email saying, hey, look, we can't, the moisture content is coming out of the field with so much moisture that we can't grind it. And my margins are very tight. And I've very rarely do I have, you know, most people that know, that are willing to pay the price, know why. You know, I'm not charging you $15 for a loaf of bread because I'm making $15. I cost me a lot more, especially where I'm using local grains. But I had issues where I would mix entire batches of dough and it just wasn't absorbing the water. And I was ending up with these, you know, just completely changes. So it just goes down the line. The problems go all the way down the line. So they ended up having to pull their organic bread flour because they said there's just too much moisture in the grain. And when we're grinding it, it's not viable basically anymore. And so, yeah, it's crazy how it goes. Although I will say on some levels, I think the pandemic, although I do think people have forgotten this. And some of that is, you're right, it's tight for everybody. And I understand that. But it also showed people that we have these small local food systems in place. So when the big grocery store does not have milk, eggs, and bread, guess who does? Your local farmer has those things. You can still feed your family. And so I think it actually helps people discover, a lot of us, you know, oh, there, I have a farm down the road. I can just get eggs from them. This is amazing. Or, you know, I can get my vegetables from them, or whatever it is. So it did sort of remind people that we're here and you have to support us, or we are going to go away. I know several people who, if their spouses didn't work a full-time job, they can't, like, farming isn't a fully sustainable thing. So it can be a little frustrating when people sort of balk at the price of a chicken, and you go, well, that $10 chicken, rotisserie chicken that you bought from the grocery store, that's not a real price. And it's very hard to explain unless you can look at the big picture and say, again, you're buying a chicken that is probably from a very large farm that is probably supplemented by the government because they can't make, their margins are tight. And the only reason they can survive is because they're going to need that supplementing from the government so that you can buy that chicken for $10. That chicken did not cost $10 to raise. I can tell you it didn't, because I know what it costs to raise a chicken.
Yeah.
So it's like, my margins are super tight. And again, those prices in the grocery store, they're not real. So if you can explain to people why, I'll give my cost breakdown to anybody that wants to look at it. But I do find that for the people that it matters, you know, they're willing to eat less chicken in a year if they can eat good chicken. You know, if they can have that, you know, maybe one chicken a week as opposed to eating chicken for dinner every night of the week and, you know, eating their chicken breast. Right. The people that understand it definitely get it. But I'm also, last year, I ended up with a total excess of squash. And again, I'm a very small farm. It's not a lot, but we have this amazing person running the school food system, the school food program in Belchertown now. And she has gotten tons of grant money to buy food from local farms and actually pay them a fair price. But I was able to donate that squash to the school. And to me, that was like maybe my favorite thing that I've ever been able to do, even though half the kids aren't going to eat it. And it wasn't that much, you know, it was like a big case of squash. In the scheme of things, it's a little thing, but it made me realize that if I can continue to do this and help feed children, I mean, my background is culinary, but it's also education. I went to school for early childhood education, and I can't imagine anything more important than feeding children and feeding your community. So anytime I am able to donate food, any excess of anything, it makes me so happy to do it. And it's, again, it's not even about making the money off of it. It's about knowing that, like, I'm growing good, nutritious food, and then that food is going to families that can afford it. And if they can't, that they can maybe still have a chance to have that, you know, nutritious food. So shout out to Barrett Graziosos, I believe is her name, but she has done such amazing things. And a lot of the other local farms have been able to sell their products to the school system. So now you have children eating locally produced nutritious food. And it's such a beautiful thing.
It's beautiful. That sounds like an excellent program. So I'm wondering, because you're so interested in education, if somebody came to you or somebody came to one of your classes and said, "Hey, I think I'd really like to get into farming," what advice would you give them?
I mean, a passion for it is definitely first and foremost, because there are going to be really hard things that you're going to have to do. That at the end of the day, if you don't have the passion for it, it's going to be really hard. It's going to be a hard pill to swallow. But I would never discourage somebody from doing it. I would just say, don't jump the gun. don't just go in and assume that you can just get going, because again, we're undoing a lot of things that, even with some knowledge going in and having done some research, we're undoing things that we did when we started. Yeah. I would just say, have a plan, make your observations, really that you're looking at, and any property can be farmed, truly. Like, you can produce food on any piece of property. We are on a forested north slope. Mm-hmm. I can still produce food. It may put me a whole month behind, you know, the bottom of the hill. We're also up very high. So I would say, just do your research and plan, and look at what is, like, feasible for you. I am one person running a farm all by myself all summer long, because my husband works 60 plus hours every summer so that we have enough money for the winter time. So see what's attainable and see what you want to do with the space, but let the space talk to you, and then go from there, and just have your plan in place. And it's going to change. Of course it will. But you have to be able to continue the observation and continue to learn and grow. But I would never discourage somebody from farming, especially if they're really passionate about it, because there's so much you can do, especially if you, you know, are working through regenerative agriculture. You can do some really amazing things in even a smaller space than most people can realize. So I would say go for it, but just have a plan.
It kind of goes back to what you're saying, that we're not really competition. Everybody has to eat, right? And we need more people who at least want to give this a shot to try it and see how it goes. And you're right. You can produce a lot of food on a very tiny spot. Who'd have thought? And when we started, we probably started about 13 years ago now. So a couple of years before you all started. And we thought, oh, we're going to have all these acres. We do have all these acres. We do have the farm that we're on is large. But you don't necessarily need it all. You can do so much on a tiny little space. And it's kind of fun, I think, to work with farmers who are on a tiny little scale. It just really jazzes me to see how much people can do.
Yeah, it's
on that scale.
And that is also another good point. What I would say to somebody looking at farming is like, reach out to your other, find out who your people are so that you can, you know, support each other and like help each other through difficulties. But also again, like, oh, hey, you've got your orchards covered. Like, I don't need to be producing apples. If you're producing apples, what can I grow on my property that can, you know, we can work together and sort of fill the gaps of the food system together. I have a good friend, Ellie, who owns Phoenix Orchard. And unfortunately she had to sell a good portion of it. But she's still on the property because it was a 100-acre monoculture farm and one person cannot do that. And she's slowly trying to turn it around to be more of a polyculture. But we've worked together tons of times on trying to help fill in those gaps and say like, okay, well, I'm not going to produce apples because she's got apples covered. The things I'm growing are different than what she's growing. So I think that's also really helpful too, to have those other small farmers around you. And I'm not saying all old school farmers are bad. Some of them can be very progressive as well. It
right.
Doesn't necessarily.
For sure. Yeah. For sure. It's nice to have that diversity too in our food system. There are things that maybe we produce traditionally in this area. We could be also growing some other things or raising some other things that kind of not only fill the gap as far as varieties go, but start to fill the gap around the year. Things that grow outside of our traditional sort of whatever it is, 22, 24, 26 weeks, right? That we can still eat from for the rest of the year. So I have one last question for you. It's a fun one. If you could have three famous people to dinner, living or historic, who would they be and why?
So I'm going to cheat a little bit. if that's allowed. My first is like three people who are like semi-famous, but they're from like now. And they're people that they're all UK based and they've been very influential in like what I've been doing. And I'd love to have them come see what I'm doing. And that would be Charles Dowding, who's like the godfather of No Dig. Mm-hmm. Hugh Richards, who is also anybody who doesn't know him. He has a really great, he has several books, but he has a YouTube channel. And Tanya Anderson from Lovely Greens, who I have like a virtual friendship with, and she just seems so lovely. She's on the Isle of Man and she's very, her videos are great for, you know, small scale food production, like self food production. So I would have them over. It would be very fun. And the second would be Theodore Roosevelt, which I know is kind of out there. He's problematic in some ways, but he's always been my most fascinating president because he was so committed to preservation, like land preservation. And I would just be really interested to, I mean, I guess you could sort of say George Washington would also probably be interested in what I was doing here because he loved to farm too. But Theodore Roosevelt has just always been such an interesting character to me. I would love to like sit down and have him to dinner.
Yeah.
And then this one is kind of out of left field. But I just heard a podcast about him. Excuse me for my pronunciation. Nikolai Ivanovich Vavole. I cannot say it. He's Russian. But he was a Russian scientist who basically started the first food bank. And so he was looking, he was studying plants and trying to like figure out which species could help feed the most people. And he just sounded like an amazing, interesting character. And if he didn't do what he did, we would not have a lot of the seeds that we have now, because he preserved so many of those seeds in that seed bank. So if nothing else, I would just love to say thank you and shake his hand and
just kind of got chills.
Give him some of my self-save seeds, because he's a really sort of like forgotten character in history, I think, but incredibly important. Like I can't think of anybody almost that's more important than him at this point.
That's great. That's so much fun.
Everybody should go learn about him, but I'm sorry, I don't.
I'll put it down in the show notes so people can check all of those out. And maybe somebody will be inspired the way you were.
It's really amazing. I mean, if nothing else, it should inspire you to save seeds, because it's so important for preservation.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Lindsay, it was so much fun talking to you today. Thanks so much for coming on.
You as well. Thank you.
This episode of the Massachusetts Farm to Table podcast is brought to you by Renaissance Farms Permaculture and the shop at Renaissance Farms. Please visit them online, and while you're there, sign up for the weekly newsletter and get 15% off your next order from the shop. Each edition of the newsletter includes farm news, articles, recipes, and updates on upcoming classes, courses, workshops, and special events. Subscribers also receive exclusive subscriber-only discounts each week. Links are in the show notes. Thank you for joining us on another delicious journey through the Massachusetts Farm to Table podcast. If you enjoyed today's episode, be sure to subscribe, rate, and review us on your favorite podcast platform. And don't forget to follow us on social media and join our Facebook group, where you can join the local farm-to-table movement. Links are in the show notes. If you have any questions, feedback, or suggestions for future guests, we'd love to hear from you. Please drop us a line at massachusettsfarmtotable@gmail.com. Until next time, remember to eat local, support your farmers, and keep the farm-to-table movement moving. Thanks for listening.